All right. My first question is, in this chapter in general, you draw extensively on Black Reconstruction, which was published in 1935, and from which our students have read chapters 1 and 2, as well as chapter 17. We as a group only know these chapters from this one work by Du Bois, which we read as one moment in the development of political economy, as both a discourse and a phenomenon in the world in the period roughly from the mid 17th century until the Cold War era. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could help the students to understand a little bit how this book as a whole, which they're only reading, you know, a relatively small portion of, fits into the larger and quite long chronologically arc of Du Bois's writing career, which spanned well over half a century from the late 19th century until the post-war period and the beginning of the Cold War.
Yeah, so thanks so much for this question. Well, I'll begin by saying that the 1930s marks a transitional period for Du Bois in the development of his political thought, and is often taken as an important point in periodizing his thought. And I'll say a little bit about that. So as a Du Bois scholar, I'm not particularly partial to thinking of Du Bois's thought in periods, but be that as it may, it's worth understanding why the 1930s is taken by so many Du Bois scholars to be this, this really important transitional moment. So typically, when we think about the early Du Bois, so the Du Bois, for example, of Souls, we see somebody who is emerging as a powerful Black intellectual who is defending basic civil and political rights for the segregated African-American community. And part of this, of course, is his involvement in founding the NAACP, or co-founding the NAACP, which remains an enormously influential civil and political rights organization. And yet, in this moment, so coming out of this civil rights organizing, Du Bois is developing a really deep sensitivity to essentially the needs for Black labor protection. He's writing Black Reconstruction, sort of looking at the disproportional, devastating impact of the Great Depression on the Black community, and trying to then sort of refine his understanding of what basic civil and political rights really ought to be. So what we see here is that really an enrichment of his view of what a democracy that respects basic civil and political rights ought to be paying attention to. And specifically, I mean, they have to be paying attention to material conditions, the conditions of labor, how it's organized, who gets what, who is assigned what kind of role in the labor market, and of course, who has what sorts of access to basic material resources. So for those Du Bois scholars who are really keen on sort of developing this idea of periodization, of course, the claim would be that after sort of the 1930s, we see the emergence of a Du Bois who is, I mean, this is also by his own admission, he's reading Marx much more carefully, he's much more attuned to a critique of global capital, mm-hmm. and so forth, that's going to come out of this. But for me, sort of as a Du Bois scholar, and what I take to be important and innovative, is that if we take what Du Bois is doing in Black Reconstruction as kind of an important moment of political theorizing, what I really care about isn't so much the historical development of his political thought, when there's so much historians can say about this. But as a philosopher, what I'm really interested in is what kind of critique is he opening up for what a viable democratic theory ought to be doing? And so what he's saying in essence is that a democratic theory or conception of basic civil and political rights that isn't sensitive to the organization of labor markets is useless, right? It's not going to give us the promise of freedom that emancipation was supposed to deliver. And so what is continuous then, I think, in sort of what Du Bois is doing from Soles to Black Reconstruction, and even, you know, in his later period, is that he's sort of looking at the United States from the perspective of the enslaved and the formerly enslaved, and saying that, let's look out into the world and see what is lacking from their vantage points. And asking this deeper, sort of richer question is, well, what would real freedom actually entail? And so when he's writing Black Reconstruction, he's sort of looking at the, what he calls this long shadow that slavery has cast onto the polity, and not just in the public sphere, but specifically in the way that Black laborers continue to be denigrated and exploited. And so that if we're ever going to realize a real sort of robust vision of a democratic society, we have to be really paying careful attention to the labor conditions of formerly enslaved persons and their descendants.
Yeah, thanks so much. And I think that answer really brings us in and thinking about Du Bois' contribution to democratic theory, you know, in a moment of, profound reconsideration of Marxist thought, mm-hmm. As a political economist, right? Not as the prophet of the coming of communism, but really careful, right, historical analysis of the conditions of laborers as citizens or otherwise, right? And Du Bois makes this really unique contribution. I think you point to this as well, in particular, you know, in a subchapter of this fifth chapter that we're talking about today and that I'll be sharing with the students as well, which is called Second Slavery and mm-hmm. Democratic Theory, right? And I think that this is that long shadow, right, that slavery mm-hmm. casts. And I just wanted to read, so on page 129, you quoted some length from the reading that the students have done for today from Du Bois. And I just wanted to quote in part from this long quote that comes on page 13 of Black Reconstruction, where Du Bois writes that the true significance of slavery in the United States to mm-hmm. the whole social development of America lay mm-hmm. in the ultimate relation of slaves to democracy. What were to be the limits of democratic control in the United States if mm-hmm. all labor, right, and now expressly making this link between worker and citizen, right, mm-hmm. Or new citizen or emancipated free citizen, if all labor, Black as well as white, became free, were given schools and the right to vote, what control could or should be set to the power and action of these laborers? Mm-hmm. What's the role of the mass of Americans to be unlimited and the right to rule extended to all men, regardless of race and color? Or if not, what power of dictatorship would rule? Mm-hmm. And how would property and privilege be protected? And the quote goes on in your book, but I think that, right, that use of dictatorship, right, mm-hmm. Indicates what you're really calling attention to mm-hmm. In the face of the defeat of the Confederacy, right, and the ascendancy of federal government, you know, in this period of so-called radical reconstruction after the end of the Civil War, as you sort of paraphrase this and I think maybe sharpen it a bit, right, you write, were African Americans to enter the polity as free and equal legal citizens, not only, and here I stress something that I think you've been stressing in your answer already, not only must the federal government change its laws, right? So not only civic and political rights must be enshrined as in the 13th to 15th Amendments, but it must also reorganize civil society and industry, which had never before accommodated a free Black yeah. labor force. So I emphasize those phrases, right, to motivate this question, you know, in what ways are the legal and formal features of the state and membership in the state, so like citizenship as such, interwoven with the material institutions of the state in relation to private market actors and membership in the labor force. Maybe you could say a bit more about, you know, what in your mind Du Bois uniquely has to say about the interlocking of these questions in the period of radical reconstruction.
Oh, excellent questions. So let me just preface my remarks by saying that I think your question for me is opening up a distinctive contribution that Du Bois makes that's been, in my view, wholly neglected by contemporary democratic theory and really 20th century political philosophy. In particular, I think Du Bois's critique of Marx is, to me, far more interesting than somebody like Habermas, although they are, in a way, sort of developing an analogous argument. And it's something to the effect of, how do we give Marx a democratic politics, one that then delivers us substantive political demands and ultimately gains that a centralized state could take up in order to advance and actualize the equal standing of all? So that's roughly what a sort of a Marxist democratic theory ought to be doing. And sort of, and that's what I take to be sort of so important in sort of expanding the normative dimension of his Marxist critique of democratic theory. But there's also so much to be said, and again, all still by way of prefacing and not actually answering your question, is what Du Bois's unique standing in sort of Black Marxist thought and why he was loath for so long to just take up this mantle and saying, like, I'm a Marxist or a communist. And so much of, you know, it's for so long he resisted it because of his emphasis on the normative value of civic equality and his emphasis on basic civil and political rights. So for him, obviously, civil and political rights, they're not just a mouthpiece to white supremacist power, nor are they simply a vehicle for capital, right, to exercise power. He thinks that they are a meaningful and a crucial way to assert one's equality publicly, particularly as a formerly enslaved Black American. And so this is all sort of by way of speaking to the power of his critique and situating it essentially in sort of in the history of 19th and 20th century modern political thought. And there's so much more to be done. And I think sort of what I've done here is I've just taken a first step to do it, and I want to take it further. So by way of answering your questions, sort of to really appreciate what his critique of radical reconstruction is about. So part of what I'm responding to here is to the eminent Du Bois scholar, Bob Gooding Williams. So he's developed a framework for understanding Du Bois that I think is powerful, but ultimately incomplete. So part of the worry here is that you have a way of interpreting what Du Bois is doing here. And this is, in Gooding Williams' words, is a way, these are interpretive strands that define what he calls Afro-modern political thought. And what makes Afro-modern political thought what it is it's concerned with white supremacy. What's white supremacy as a political system? And so the point being that either we could understand sort of Afro-modern political thought as defending integration into the state, into the polity as is, or we could understand Afro-modern political thought as demanding what Bob Gooding Williams calls a radical reconstitution of the existing state. And he describes Du Bois, as many others have, as an integrationist, right? That, and this is the fatal flaw in Du Bois, that really what Du Bois is doing is that he wants, and this is sort of Gooding-Williams' language here, is that, let me see if I could quote him verbatim, if I could remember. He wants African-Americans or freedmen to assimilate, to use his language, to assimilate to the norms of American modernity. Mm. And sort of when I first read this as a graduate student, I was like, what does it mean to assimilate to the norms of modernity, right? I mean, it would be one thing to say you're assimilating to certain kind of cultural or social mores, but to assimilate to the norms of modernity, right? That didn't strike me as an adequate characterization of what assimilation is, or sort of using that kind of phrasing. And it certainly didn't strike me as an adequate characterization of what Du Bois is doing. And I thought, well, what better way to illustrate that than to really sort of showcasing the power of his critique of radical reconstruction. So what Du Bois is saying, so obviously we're coming out of an enormously violent, cataclysmic war that shook the country to its very foundations. I mean, it's a war that for Du Bois is really marking the rise of American modernity. So the notion that Du Bois is just demanding some kind of passive assimilation to American modernity as if it's a fixed thing, and that to the extent that any group isn't assimilating to it, then that somehow manifests a moral failure, that already makes no sense, because we're already dealing with a thing where sort of what American modernity means isn't fixed. It's up for grabs, and it's in a way sort of dripping with violence. So like it's a pitched battle, sort of defining what it means to be free, to be an American, to be an American citizen. And so I really wanted to capture that fundamental dynamism, that crisis, in effect, at the heart of modernity, and that to the extent that Du Bois is keen on asserting some kind of vision of American civic nationalism or civic equality, he's giving us that vision, and at the same time making room or sort of demanding that we appreciate these mechanisms that make possible the remaking of America, essentially. Mm-hmm. And of course, that story of if we're going to remake an America that's worth being a part of, we have to have an understanding of sort of what are the conditions of Black freedmen? What are the labor conditions specifically? And he describes freedmen, former slaves, walking off plantations with just the rags on their backs, who have no material basis to begin to assert any kind of formal scheme of basic civil and political rights. And so, and in the quote that you're saying, it's like, well, let's imagine a democracy where we have true dictatorship of the proletariat in the sense that it's not just that we're going to demand particular material goods, which is, of course, crucial. So, for example, the demand for land, the demand for a living wage, the demand for inclusive unions, right? These are specific demands that are being made by freedmen. But more than that, right, it's a demand for rethinking and reimagining what the American state should be. So, for example, who should be part of the American state and what the scope of the public sphere ought to be. So coming out of this is a new conception for Du Bois of what constitutes the public good in the United States. And part of it, again, is a pitched battle between the scope of what can be a public resource, like education, like childcare. And these are ways, so if you take something like public education, where we take to be eo ipso, yeah, of course, that's just part of the rights of citizenship. Du Bois calls, he calls bull on that, right? He's like, that's not quite true, because we actually see it coming out of the demands that ex-slaves are making, say, if my freedom is going to be substantive, if I'm going to be a true equal, then you have a claim for the rights to free public education at the expense of the state. And this is, like, to go back to that quote that you read, I think this is the untapped power of Du Bois's critique that goes sort of, I think, beyond anything I've read, and sort of thinking about the true material conditions of democratic self-determination, and ultimately sort of clarifying the normative ideal of civic equality and what's at stake in Black inclusion.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think especially that last statement really resonates with my experience of reading the chapter, where the material conditions, right, of of substantive civic emancipation, right, this idea that that the condition of being a freed man, being a freedman in Du Bois's sense in the chapter, and the sort of travesty of the dissolution of the Freedmen's Bureau, which I think is not something that Americans, however critical they may be, or are knowledgeable about American politics, like I think as readers of this chapter, we learn something about that, or we learn something about the dimensions of what Du Bois is seeing, in that period of radical Reconstruction. And the demand, to the what might seem a rather arcane kind of demand to, like, radically change our historiography of that period, being connected to these really foundational issues about the project of integration, assimilation. I mean, the ways that we think about the color line, right, being the problem of the 20th century, to quote Du Bois from elsewhere. But I guess one thing I'd like to maybe anchor that in, which I thought was really delightful and interesting and would be glad to hear more about, and I think would resonate, with the students too, given, some of the things that they've been thinking about, is how you spend some time a little bit later in the chapter from where I quoted just earlier. So I'm looking at page 138 right now, kind of talking about Du Bois's appropriation and revision of Hegel's theory of the modern state, which, I mean, you didn't refer to here, but that feels to me like a great locus for this question of assimilation, right?
Right.
Where you could totally, I could imagine, right, a political philosophy of the 21st century taking Du Bois's gesture to Hegel as assimilative, let's say, maybe, or something like that. So in your kind of retelling here, the emphasis on self-consciousness, the self-consciousness of emancipation in individual and collective action in reformulating state society and state individual relations is really integral to the project of changing the historiography of the period of radical Reconstruction. And you kind of anchored this in some of the middle chapters of the book of Du Bois's Black Reconstruction, which we haven't read. And so I was wondering if maybe you could open up a little bit, some of what you found in your kind of reconstruction, I mean, your textual reconstruction of his argument with respect to maybe very particularly the labor activism of formerly enslaved persons. You spoke about education, but maybe help us to see a little bit more about what that labor activism looked like and why it seems important. And maybe also kind of, reflecting on that, if you have thoughts, to how that's really salient, right, in 1935, right, when all these questions had sort of reopened again, right, and the question of what state society relations, and maybe in particular the role of the labor movement and its own, right, struggles with racial integration or refusal, right, on the part of many powerful people in the labor movement to integrate the movement, right, if that seems salient, I guess, to the way that he's retelling that story and why he would want this sort of appropriated and revised Hegelian story at all, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, let me begin by saying a little bit about the Freedmen's Bureau, and this might connect to why it's worth talking about Hegel's theory of the state in connection to Du Bois's understanding of Reconstruction. So the Freedmen's Bureau was an actual institution. It was an arm of the federal government. It was part of the radical Reconstruction push after the Civil War to sort of make real the promise of freedom that emancipation was supposed to deliver for freedmen. And what Du Bois repeatedly emphasizes, and this even goes back as early as to Soles, is that the Freedmen's Bureau, first of all, it was supposed to be an institution that administered reparations. That was supposed to be its function. It did so much more than that. And on top of that, it was supposed to be permanent, right? This was supposed to be an institution that is part of the federal government whose sole purpose was this equitable integration of ex-slaves and specifically paying attention to the material conditions of their labor. And for Du Bois, this is sort of why what he's doing is going beyond an innovative and but perhaps arcane historiography of like, let's tell a different story. What's at stake here, it's still this more substantive picture of the administration of political power and sort of what does it mean to have a state that is truly serves the interests of all. And he's saying part of that picture is that we have to have a kind of a forward-facing sort of dimension of the state that's specifically addressing the needs of Black labor. And that to him is part of the vision of what true universality, right? So true freedom and equality for all must mean. And I am I am in love with this picture because it's making us think in a more sophisticated way than most liberals think about what it means to realize a universal, because you have you're appealing to the state, but you're saying that the state has this responsibility to address the needs and interests and historical experience of a particular community were it to actualize, you know, freedom and equality for all. So so that's sort of why I think sort of what Du Bois here is doing is interesting with respect to Freedmen's Bureau. So I'll say a little bit more about thinking of Hegel and Hegel's theory of the state and Freedmen, and then move on to labor rights activism. So, and we might talk about this later, but part of what I wanted to show here is that, and then sort of talking about the Freedmen's Bureau, is that it's important to Du Bois to show that there were real successes coming. It wasn't all just failure, right? It wasn't, so if you look at sort of even American history, it's not just this story of one brutal form of domination after another, but there's stories of resistance by oppressed groups, specifically by slaves and ex-slaves, that generate substantive gains, substantive wins. And Du Bois wants to sort of hold on to that vision because it really spells sort of the promise of American democracy. It gives us something worth hoping for. And when I sort of, in turning to Hegel here, what I liked about sort of looking at the philosophy of right as sort of, you know, as a framework that we could play with here is that it gives us a more concrete vision of sort of where we ought to be paying attention to in sort of in imagining the reconstruction of American democracy. And it falls really neatly in line with Du Bois. We have to pay attention to the state, the family and labor relations. And these are exactly sort of the institutional foci that Du Bois is saying have been these sites of pitched battles, ongoing contestation, but also of some modest wins that he thinks they're worth emphasizing. I will also say there's, to my knowledge, almost no work done on this connection at all. And I mean, I could say more about why that is, but I'm just sort of, it's very exciting to chart these connections. And so this goes back to, so let's specifically talk about the institutional focus of labor. And so famously, Hegel doesn't have a solution to the problem of the integration of labor in a modern polity. He says the conditions are just so bad, they're so chaotic. A capitalist civil society is necessarily going to generate essentially a downtrodden underclass, and that there's going to be no way for a modern capitalist state to subsume them. It's just not going to happen. And there's something that here that I think Du Bois's picture is a response to and a challenge. So he's saying, if capital, or like if the United States as a capitalist society can't find a viable way of integrating Black labor, then the promise of freedom and democracy is undeliverable. It will never happen. And so there are these moments where Du Bois is saying, yeah, radical reconstruction was a failure. And it's a splendid failure because it's pointing to a deep problem, I think, more generally in the history of sort of essentially normative political theorizing under capitalism, which is like, how are we ever going to build a society that's worth its salt, where everyone has the opportunity to really flourish as individuals? So he's in a, it's like almost a direct response to this problem, particularly that I think Hegel's political philosophy makes so vivid. But what's unique about Du Bois is that he's giving us a kind of a picture that's so rich in historical particularity, and making front and center Black labor activism as resisting sort of essentially collapse of sort of the conditions of their well-being and self-determination in the light of the chaotic free market forces they're experiencing. Because in a way, it's like what you have is, you know, Black freedmen and ex-slaves are emerging into a capitalist society and trying to find a way to keep their dignity, to assert their humanity, and to have a material basis for their flourishing and their well-being. And obviously, right, this is happening in the context where a free market society is going to try to exploit and denigrate the labor of anybody. But this is specifically happening in a period where Black workers have no visibility whatsoever as political agents. And so what Du Bois is showing is that, first of all, it's amazing the kind of forces that they had to confront, right? They have to confront a society that is, in general, completely dismissive of the interests of workers and the interests of labor. They have to confront sort of the inherent tension within such a capitalist society between capital and labor. And on top of that, they have to confront a trade union movement that's pretty strong in this period, but it's completely white nationalist. I mean, the rhetoric at the time is that, like, white laborers, we're the true slaves of capital. And like this complete sort of failure of moral imagination to imagine an interracial labor movement, which, by the way, I think Du Bois is absolutely right in saying that failure of imagination ultimately spelled the doom of the labor movement, and it hasn't been able to recover. So it's like the problem of the color line, the problem of integrating the labor movement, I think remains a site of very serious social conflict in this country, that until we get through it, we're not going to be able to resist capital successfully. I think Du Bois is just completely right about this, that we're not going to do it. So anyway, so Black labor is coming out of sort of the antebellum period and is organizing as a political force in an extremely hostile context, right? The union and the industrial North and the union movement there completely doesn't care about their interests. They remain invisible as a political labor force. And of course, in the context of the Confederate South, or the very recently Confederate South, they're quite keen. I mean, the way that Du Bois puts it is such pithy, kind of clever and heartbreaking language, the way that white Southerners, particularly those who own any capital, the way they look at Black labor, like any dollar paid to a Black worker is a dollar fleeced from the white community. So it's like Black labor is in between a rock and a hard place. And yet what's so beautiful about Du Bois, he says, but there are wins here too. There are ways that Black laborers end up even behind the color line coming together to mobilize, to demand land, to go on farmers going on strike, organizing, he talks about within Black churches to satisfy the needs of children for education, food, shelter, essentially trying to, in some way, however imperfectly, provide an institutional basis for the flourishing of the Black labor force in a context where at best they're invisible and at worst they're subject to violence, right? So a lot of the kind of Black-led labor strikes that are happening are, they are prompting attacks by the white people, right? By, you know, they're called race riots, but they're really just white mob attacks that destroy Black communities and any kind of tiny modicum of wealth that they're building. In any case, so that's all a very long answer. And it's, at the very least, it's an invitation to read more Du Bois, to stay with him, because I do think sort of what he's doing here could potentially offer solutions to problems that people like Kant and Hegel and Rawls, I mean, all sorts of political philosophers have been wrestling with, but they're not gonna find an answer because they don't read Du Bois, or they're not paying attention to like the actual details on the ground of what's happening in the organizing of Black laborers against what, you know, people like Hegel are describing as an unresolvable tension between labor and capital. It's like, well, what does that tension look like? If a group is being subject to that tension and have absolutely nothing, right? What could then possibly be the conditions of their self-determination in these non-ideal contexts? What ought to be their political demands? I mean, frankly, what should they do? Mm-hmm. And Du Bois is like, let's follow through that question. And if we hear their answer, then potentially we have an answer to essentially all of our problems. Like, here's a way of really sort of building a better state, building a better democracy. And that's what I'm trying to do here. That's what I'm trying to reconstruct here, that goes beyond just saying we need a different understanding of history. We need that and so much more.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've said an awful lot in this direction, but my last question kind of invites you directly to say a bit more about what you discuss in the concluding section of the chapter, where you do explicitly go beyond kind of the ambit of also this class session on Du Bois's Black Reconstruction, go beyond the retelling of the story of radical Reconstruction as, in a certain sense, a failure, but a splendid failure, mm-hmm. which is a quote, which I'll re-quote because it's such a such a wonderful encapsulation, maybe, of what we're offered. And then right, to go beyond that to what you call the contemporary implications of second slavery, which you've been doing. But I suppose I wanted to maybe sharpen it a bit by pointing in two directions, both of which have sort of come up, but you haven't made an express comment on in the way that you do in the chapter. And I'd invite you in a way maybe even to go beyond explicitly what you say in the chapter, because it seems to me there's a thought, you know, behind it about, right, non-ideal political theory today, right, and what it can learn from Du Bois. And so the two directions I have in mind, I mean, one still connects to the historical context of the writing of the book, which would just be, right, like Du Bois struggles himself in the 30s with what to do about the New Deal, right? And, you know, here's an invitation, if you wish, right, to help us to see like what's going on there, and why or how that might be relevant to things that we're thinking through today, or as you put it, right, sort of how the issue of the color line has never really been resolved, right? And until it's resolved, we're not gonna find solutions. We Americans are not gonna find political solutions to the big problems, which come up again in this legislative session, right?
Yeah.
You know, with the so-called human infrastructure bill, let's say. Mm-hmm. And then the other one would just be, if you wished, right, to say a bit about contemporary phenomena like mass incarceration or the prison industrial complex on the one hand, or the Walmartification of the labor market, right, and the failure of the organizing drive, you know, just this past summer. Right, does Du Bois, in your mind, you know, have something to offer as we think through these kinds of questions, right? Like sort of the ongoing legacy of the color line from the New Deal and how that manifests in the quote unquote New Deal and the Green New Deal that we talk about today, and some of these, you know, some of these other sort of tropes of contemporary political economic controversies or crises.
So Du Bois initially welcomed the New Deal with open arms. You know, he was always looking for that second reconstruction, right? A continuation of the work that the Freedmen's Bureau should have continued to do, you know, through the 20th century and now. And he was excited about it. But he very quickly realized, as many historians now accepted, that the New Deal was structured by the color line, as most everything was at the time. And precisely the community that needed special attention and care, namely descendants of slaves, were excluded from it, right? So there are these racial restrictions that conditioned access to state-provided support. And this is, in a way, sort of goes back to your first question, which is sort of thinking about the 1930s and why Du Bois he goes back to writing on Reconstruction. And so he had enjoyed so much popularity and support, right? Becoming a well-known and celebrated civil rights activist. Mm-hmm. And in the 1930s, he begins to use The Crisis, which is the premier magazine or outlet of the NAACP, to start defending Black self-segregation. And part of that is his worry about how the color line is impacting Black labor, and in particular, working class and poor Black communities. And what's so interesting is that he's doing this, he's like, it's not like I don't believe in, you know, basic civil and political rights for all. I mean, it's like, he's like, I'm never not going to be a liberal like that. And he says it again and again. And sorry, and he continues to criticize communists, the American Communist Party, for denigrating the importance of basic rights. And yet he starts defending Black self-segregation precisely because he thinks that if we're talking about at least short-term access to substantive material goods, like, you know, having some kind of informal system for poverty relief, having some kind of at least semblance of economic security, is like, let's patronize Black businesses, let's support Black business. we need a way of sort of becoming economically self-sufficient in a context where, you know, we have very few other opportunities for flourishing, right? For satisfying our most basic needs. And so where does that leave us sort of in thinking about sort of the legacy of Jim Crow and where we are now? Mm-hmm. So in this critique that he's making of the New Deal and sort of the why he ends up parting ways with the NAACP, it really speaks to a distinction. I don't know if you folks are reading Kant's, but so in part one of the Metaphysics of Morals, right, Kant makes this distinction between being subject to state power, right? So being an equal subject of the law and being an equal citizen of the law. And those two things don't necessarily overlap. And I think this is exactly what Du Bois is talking about, right? When we're thinking about sort of the legacy of second slavery and what ends up happening with Black disenfranchisement on the heels of the New Deal, you have Black Americans sort of entering the public sphere on the basis of formal equality, right? Equality is written into the law and essentially sort of, to borrow the cliche, equal on paper. they're subject to state power, right? So that the policing of Black bodies being sort of held and like crushed by state power, that's part of what it means to be a citizen of a polity, right? That's definitely happening with in the Black community, right? The whole force of state power is being subject and like expressed on the state, on the body, on Black bodies, on the Black community. But none of that is even coming close to achieving this original vision of freedom that Du Bois had in mind. And that original freedom called for not just formal equality before the law, where you're equally subject to state power, sort of something like what Kant is imagining, but that you have a meaningful opportunity to change the law. You have a meaningful opportunity to impact the conditions of your labor. That's obviously not happening in the New Deal, and seldom is it happening today. Mm-hmm. So, and this is particularly hard to talk about in sort of after the civil rights era. We kind of went through this strange period where after the civil rights era, we are living in a colorblind society. And a lot of those ways of talking about politics and race don't really make sense today. And perhaps we have in our lifetimes the opportunity to advance another radical reconstruction, to lead sort of the country to meaningful change. And what that would mean, I think, is continuing to follow Du Bois's cue here, is to say, let's actually pay attention to the conditions of labor. What are the prevailing conditions? How are persons basically locked into structural subordination that essentially saps their capacity for political self-determination? Sometimes it's explicit, like in the phenomena, widely documented phenomena of mass incarceration in the United States, which is one of the biggest de jure slave labor forces in the world. If you are enslaved, if you are imprisoned in the US, you're essentially enslaved. And because of the rise of privatization, your labor is sold. I mean, it's contracted out to private parties who make a killing. And then it's, of course, widely documented that you can't vote, like you lose your basic rights, right? So this is a very obvious case of being a second slave, being a slave all over again. And this disproportionately targets communities of color, specifically Black communities, but there are also more subtle ways that this is happening, although with quite a similar effect. So when we talk about Walmart being the biggest employer in the private sector in the United States, that this creates a very, very weak basis for labor to organize. I mean, to even demand a union, much less sort of be in a position to make substantive political demands that can make possible the original vision Du Bois had, which is nationalizing public resources, right? Democracy in the workplace, access to education, right? The true flourishing of the individual, like the prevailing labor conditions and the way that they're happening kind of in real time, really don't give us much to hope for that we could ever achieve true emancipation. And in some ways, it's like the shadow of slavery is still with us. And it calls for us to be, I think, still sensitive to the thing that Americans were so bad at, which is building an interracial political movement. Interracial political solidarity, right? This has to be the promise. This has to be the future of American democracy if we're ever going to have a future.
Well, thank you, Alvira, so much for that and for that call to action as an American. And I'm also thinking as we have this conversation about the interesting, the interesting ways this resonates and amplifies as we think mm-hmm. about, we think about these questions, from the different standpoints that we, in this course maybe come from. I think there's a commonplace view that somehow, I mean, the reference to Habermas also maybe triggered this thought in me, that somehow to have the conversation about Marx and democratic theory with Du Bois rather than Habermas is, of course, to have the conversation with an American, who's so sensitive to the issues of, mm-hmm. Of the color line as the issue of the 20th century. And obviously that hasn't changed, I think. And that's something, that's very different, right? From the perspective of a Habermas. Whereas on the other hand, of course, you have social market economics, maybe, in continental Europe, and that kind of interestingly inflects some of the things we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. So thanks for giving us so much to think about, and hopefully we'll be able to welcome you virtually in Berlin to talk about this stuff live at some point.
My pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
Okay.